Kia ora tātou, one and all. Good to see you here. At least it's not raining or blowing yet, but spring is upon us. As chair of the Palestine Defence Heritage Advisory Group, it's great to be able to hold these midday monthly military history presentations, and co-hosting these along with the Palestine City Library and the Engineer Charitable Trust. Back in May, I think it was, Dave, wasn't it? Your presentation on Confrontasi, looking at the land aspect of the conflict in Borneo, Malaya and Indonesia. So today what we have is the naval representation of what happened during that period in Southeast Asia. So can we welcome Richard Jackson, retired Commander, Royal New Zealand Navy, who's a bit of an expert in these areas. It's always good to have Richard back, so please welcome Richard. Without further ado, we'll get you underway.
All right, well, good morning, good afternoon, and thank you all very much for coming. Yes, I'm quite conscious this is kind of part two of a series, and the hard reality with confrontation is it tends to have been forgotten by New Zealand, in New Zealand history. It's sort of vanished from the culture. It was, of course, if you'll see in that sort of time frame, immediately overtaken by the Vietnam War and lots of other issues. But confrontation, as I'll try and point out, was a serious conflict. Fortunately, it was a managed conflict, and the naval aspect, and I'll touch a wee bit on the Air Force aspect, is primarily a story of successful deterrence so that the soldiers on the ground could get on with the actual battles. And so this is what we'll talk through. I'll try and just take you back to 1962, a very different world. And Indonesia itself, which as an independent nation had it, I was a bit surprised at just how violent its history is. And make the point about the Indonesian Navy and Air Force that had the potential to be very serious opponents. And then I'll talk through the two naval aspects. And the first one is that there is a large Commonwealth naval force of serious ships, as you saw in that cover picture. And the other point is that there was the inshore flotilla, and they were the poor blokes who did all the work, bad charts, hot climate, and they were the ones who confronted the Indonesian infiltrators directly. So back in 1962, there's quite a lot on here, and I hope it's reasonably clear. China was a sort of big unknown threat. They had intervened in the Korean War. They appeared to be willing to be supportive of overseas Chinese if they were wanting to be rebellious. And they were also caught up in the towards the end of the Great Leap Forward, which wasn't all that successful, a sort of giant industrialization program. And then they were going to launch very soon into the Cultural Revolution, which was sort of Mao's last gasp at staying revolutionary. The Soviet Union was active, supportive, and building arms that it was happy to export to people. Indochina was in that sort of interim period. The French had left, the insurgency was there, and the Americans hadn't come in on a large scale. 1964 with the Gulf of Tonkin incident suddenly got the Americans' attention. The Philippines was an ally and a member, but it was very much a developing nation. India and Burma had basically left from British oversight and were becoming non-aligned or had become non-aligned nations, so they were not sympathetic. And Japan, of course, was trying to, its economy was growing. Its car exports were starting to boom, and it was totally dependent on the unending stream of oil tankers that went from the Middle East through the Straits of Malacca, which is between Sumatra and Malaysia, and then turning north and up to fuel the Japanese economy. So one thing you need to bear in mind is that throughout this picture, there is a constant stream of merchant ships through the Straits of Malacca and then up to Japan, South Korea, and indeed Taiwan. So there's a constant background from a naval point of view of international shipping that potentially vulnerable. So that's the big picture. Indonesia itself had taken several years to go through its war of independence with the Dutch, which, like any war of independence, has got its horror stories on both sides. They then had to fight several campaigns against separatists in Sumatra, Borneo. Java is the predominant island in Indonesia, and it's fairly easy to scratch an Indonesian from one of the other areas, and they'll speak of Javanese perhaps a bit as we might speak of Aucklanders, the sort of, oh, them, they think they're in charge. And more immediately, in the time frame we're concerned with, 1960-62, the Indonesians, for the sake of completing their colonialist, anti-colonialist rebellion, had wanted to take over Western Papua New Guinea, which ethnically, culturally and whatnot was a considerable error. But in the 1960s, and the mood of the UN, they had support, including from the United States, to do that, and the Dutch were forced out by a successful program of confrontation. And so, as you know and you'll recall from the previous talk, the Indonesians had the same view about the former British colonies. This is a rather unsatisfactory map of Indonesia because I didn't have any names on it, but I hope you're aware. So Sumatra and an oil-producing area, Borneo or Kalimantan, and the former British colonies, the Philippines is up here, the various other islands. East Timor, of course, was simply part of Indonesia at that point. It hadn't become independent. This is so-called West Irian, PNG, the west side of PNG, and that, of course, is where trouble is bubbling away today. The Sunda and the Lombok Straits, important international waterways. So that sort of sets the scene, and obviously with Malaysia, the former Malaya, Singapore at the tip, and these colonies here becoming the new construct of Malaysia, which, as I say, the Indonesians did not like. Now, the Indonesians had a lot of support from the Soviet Union, and so they had a considerable navy, and this is the Sverdlov-class cruiser called Irian. And as you can see by the armament listed there, a very impressive piece of kit. 8 destroyers. 8 frigates. 2 rather exotic-looking Italian-built frigates, destroyer escorts, and 10 of their whiskey-class diesel submarines. Now, if you think just in terms of the capabilities of that equipment, there's a considerable threat if you're in anybody else's warship. And they also had the Komar-class fast attack craft, which were designed to be missile-launching ships. And throughout confrontation, the Commonwealth navies, had to treat them as a significant missile-armed threat. And it wasn't, in fact, until 1972... which is what, 4 or 6 years after confrontation, that we finally learned, in fact, they didn't have operational anti-ship missiles. The Soviets hadn't actually handed over all the goodies to them. But we had to act as though they were a real threat. And as you may well be aware, the whole point of infiltration across those narrow waters, what you do is have a very innocuous-looking vessel. You might call it a sampan, as some of our narratives do. Kumpit, apparently, is the Indonesian term. Diesel-powered. They can have masts and sails, carry a bit of cargo. And most of them are innocent fishermen or traders or maybe just simply commercial smugglers, which we didn't mind. But some of them would be carrying explosives, Indonesian marines, and they would be trying to infiltrate not only in West Malaysia, but also into the Borneo territories. So Kumpit was the target that our forces were mostly looking for. And there is, I think, an important message from the Indonesian Air Force, which again, Soviet supplied. They had the Badger bombers, which carried the AS-1 Kinnel anti-ship missile, which you can see is kind of like a rather chubby radar-controlled plane, but nonetheless a threat. And the Beagle twin-engine bomber, a bit similar to the Canberra that was in our service, and they were equipped, amongst other weapons, obviously, with air-launched torpedoes. So they too were a very direct threat to a naval force. Before everything had sort of broken down with the relationships, the Indonesians had bought Ferry Gannet anti-submarine aircraft from the Brits. And again, the point here, if you think of the frigates and destroyers, if you're in a British or Australian submarine, you had to go very carefully because there was some reasonably good kit that might be out looking for you. The Indonesian Air Force also had for fighter defence the array of MiGs, MiG-17s, MiG-19s and ultimately MiG-21s. Some of you may know John Lanham, who's a former Air Force pilot, and he was part of the RNZAF contingent up there. He subsequently, when he was an aide to one or other of our ministers of defence, got to visit the Indonesian airfield that had been his target had the balloon gone up. And he was a bit relieved to see that the MiG-21s back then, again, this is in the 70s, all had flat tyres, so they weren't going to be taking off in a hurry. But let's not, I mean, it's easy to be sort of rude about the Indonesians and sophisticated kit, but in that 62-66 period, they had Soviet advisors, they had a government that was keen to make a point, and there was indeed a practical threat, both at air, by air and sea. And in fact, Indonesia was given the first surface-to-air missiles that were in the Southeast Asia region. And I make a little point down here to not forget that this presentation doesn't cover, but there was a considerable Far East Air Force who were also a major part of the deterrent aspect to keeping confrontation a manageable conflict. And so this was just a reminder. Mr. Hayward probably covered it in detail. This is a typical border post in Borneo, and because the air and sea threats were being deterred, this was the centre of gravity of the whole conflict. The men on the ground and patrolling and clashing with the Indonesian infiltrators. So that's at the heart of the conflict. And so my naval description is really part of the periphery of ensuring that the overall conflict is managed. And so there was a considerable Far East fleet. And as I've listed there, a carrier task force, an amphibious force, a submarine flotilla, a logistics force, because modern ships don't go very far without an oiler being handy, and the inshore flotilla that we'll talk of, and maintenance ships and naval bases. So firstly, this is what the Far East fleet looked like, and there are four carriers in this photo. We can identify them as Victorious, Melbourne, the Aussie carrier, Eagle, so Victorious and Eagle would have been in a rotation moment, one new on station and one about to leave. And the furthest most carrier is one of the commando carriers, the carrier battalion of Royal Marines and a bunch of helicopters. So my point is, now somewhere in there there's a New Zealand frigate and there'll probably be a couple of Australian ships because that was our commitment to the station. And I can't identify the individual escorts, but my point is this is a powerful and sophisticated fleet of that era. And so what did the main fleet do during confrontation? It had to deter the Indonesians, which we know that it did successfully. It had to be able to assist with the control of the sea lanes, the commercial sea lanes, the Straits of Malacca and in the South China Sea, be prepared to assert rights of passage, because this was before the international law of the sea was settled, and Indonesia, under the international law of the sea, has got some complicated but common sea lanes that are internationally recognised. But then right of passage was by your willingness to exert force. And diplomacy, of course, and there were all the ongoing allied commitments. The Southeast Asia Treaty Organisation was active, and so New Zealand, Australia and the Brits individually had national commitments. There were the British imperial commitments in the Indian Ocean, and the defence of Hong Kong was one of those. And of note, New Zealand had a particular commitment because of our purchase of the Lock class frigates in the 1949, that we would have frigates to assist in the defence of Hong Kong if called on to do so. And as a small anecdote, outside this period, 1961, Iraq threatened Kuwait, the entire British Eastern Fleet went hurtling over across the Indian Ocean to the Persian Gulf to respond to the Iraqis, except for the New Zealand frigate, which stayed as the Hong Kong guard ship. A real example of this particular commitment. The legend that I grew up on in the Navy was, in fact, that it was the Hong Kong laundryman who told the New Zealand ship, "Oh, you'll be staying behind." So, entirely believable, but yes. And as I say, finally, support for inshore patrols. And again, just a reminder of a big ship's sophisticated fleet and logistics afloat. So this is the first of the British Leander-class frigates, the Oiler Victorious, again, who had a lot of deployments to Southeast Asia. And this was a specialist air stores ship which carried spare parts for the aeroplanes, rarely out of sight of Victorious. And just as an example, again, one of the larger exercises, because I believe that this is Melbourne following HMS Eagle, and as you can see, a crowded flight deck, and for the time, sophisticated aircraft. So this is what we did, New Zealand, in time of confrontation. And you can see that the deployments, some of them are 12 and 14-month deployments away from home. They rapidly recognised to get down to sort of 6 or 7 month deployments. But they're a familiar set of ships. Taranaki, Otago, our two then modern frigates. Royalist, our cruiser. And they just cycled round and round and round on this commitment. And ultimately, because where's Royalist? This November 65 was the voyage in which she came home from Singapore. And she had the condensers of her boilers fail, which were at least 20-something years old. And she contaminated the boilers, broke down at sea, and was somewhat of an embarrassment. Although on behalf of the stokers in the Royalist at that time, they got the ship running, and they steamed into Auckland. They were not a useless hulk. You have to reinforce that. And because of a problem with Royalist, we had temporarily loaned Blackpool, and she came out from the UK straight to Singapore and continued our commitments to the Commonwealth Fleet. And as you'll see here, in addition, and we'll talk to them, the two minesweepers that we crewed, British-built minesweepers in reserve in Singapore, and we provided crews for those. And so just to show you what it looked like, here's Taranaki, and this, interestingly, has got the carrier Victorious in the background, and I can't identify, but an American carrier that the photo's been taken from. And the other curiosity is she's got here the initial outfit of big British-built anti-submarine torpedoes, which were heavy, slow, and we were very happy to get rid of them. And this photo is from 1959, but it's a favourite one of mine, of Royalist here in Japan, and alongside one of the British colony class cruisers, and alongside her, or across the pier, one of the big American heavy cruisers, and the two Australian battle class destroyers. So I'm not quite sure what the occasion was, but there was obviously a very heavy Commonwealth presence in Japan at the time. But I think it also shows the relative size of Royalists very well compared with the cruisers of our allies. And Otago, refueling at sea with the American-type torpedoes that we much prefer, but more importantly, she had two 20mm guns, one in each waist, and they were essentially there to shoot up compass when they did their share of the patrols off Malaysia. So there was a rather practical addition to their armament for that. And finally, just to look at Blackpool, which just comes into the sort of end of the narrative. And as an original Type 12, she's got a lot less superstructure than the Otago, the Taranaki, let alone the Leanders, that she's a relatively simple ship compared with the others. They were very proud of that fact. They were the fastest ship in the RNZN. And this is a brief look at what the commando carrier looks like, an aircraft carrier but filled with Royal Marines, and the air group is, in this case, Wessex helicopters. And the other ships that came on station in turn, the landing platform docks, Intrepid and Fearless, took turns out there as part of the support for the ground forces. Intrepid and Fearless, of course, played a part in the Falklands War. Manxman is a World War II hangover. She was a fast mine layer. Because she had big capacity for mines, that space was taken up for workshops, and she supported the small ships of the Far East Fleet. And HMAS Sydney, the Australians too, this was one of their aircraft carriers, but she became, as many of you will know, a fast troop transport, also known as the Bung Tau Ferry in later years. But she too played a part in the Borneo campaign. And the interesting one that I'd love to know more about is the British submarines. By this stage, everybody knew submarines had to stay submerged and go fast. And so the old World War II gun armament was taken off. Except when you came to confrontation, some of the A-class submarines had a 4-inch gun mounted again. And so the question is, why, and what were they doing, and how close into Indonesian waters did they go? There's some unanswered stories there that I'd love to learn. My assumption is that the submarines were deployed off the Indonesian naval base and maintained a standing watch for the sortie of any of the big Indonesian ships. And the good old days of the Sembawang naval base, so this is Victorious alongside. This is the North Wall. This is the Straits of Johor. So the causeway is up here. Also the ammunition depot is up there. And the west side leads to the big King George VI graving dock. They've got a floating dry dock. And I'm assuming this is Mull of Kerntire, a support ship I'll talk of. And down here is the Stores Basin, which is still a sort of operational basin if you're a visiting British, Australian or New Zealand ship. And in this case, it's of interest because we can see the two funnels of the cruiser HMS Belfast, and that retired, I believe, in 1962. So it's an interesting little overlap, Belfast being a museum ship in London these days. And just a small reminder of Hong Kong, and the carrier here is HMS Hermes. This has pretty much all been reclaimed. When we were in Hong Kong in 2017, there are some street names with British Admiralty type names, but as far as I'm aware, it's all reclaimed out to about this line. The Tamar and the basin has just vanished under more buildings, so it's a very different world. But that was the good old days of Hong Kong. And again, an example of the logistics and maintenance support necessary. The Brits had the aircraft carrier Triumph turned into a heavy support ship, repair ship. So this is a modified Type 12 frigate. This is an aircraft direction frigate. This is an Australian converted destroyer into a Type 15 frigate, and this is an old Lock-class frigate, not one of ours, one of the Brits. The Lock-class frigates soldiered on. This is HMS Eagle, and again, I think this is Melbourne here. So a busy time at the naval base. But the front line, aside from the heavy action of the deterrent force of the main fleet, the front line really in confrontation was the inshore flotilla. And the Brits and Malaysians and Singaporeans had manned a bunch of minesweepers. The Brits in the late 50s had the forethought to send a whole bunch of minesweepers, both these, the Tom class, because all their names end in T-O-N, and others that were the Ham class, because all their names ended in H-A-M. And they were put out in Singapore in reserve. And come confrontation, they were activated, as I say, by Malaysians, Singaporeans, the Brits themselves. The Australians had a flotilla of six of these, and they cycled them through from Australia through to Singapore for the confrontation. We did not have a comparable minesweeper, but we sent crews to man two of them, and they retained their British names, even though they were formerly Her Majesty's New Zealand ships. Now, this is what the minesweeper crews had to put up with. So these were ships designed, obviously, with British waters in mind and the British climate. So they were relatively short-ranged. So if you sailed from Singapore to Borneo, the first thing you had to do was refuel. They did have their full minesweeping equipment, both for moored mines and for magnetic, etc. mines. And that was exercised because mining was a real possibility that the Indonesians might indulge in, and they had some very large big ships to protect. So there was actual minesweeping going on as part of the time. But for confrontation, they had an additional armament, and you'll see there six Vickers guns, two Bren guns, and I'll speak to those later. And you had to train your crews for boarding the Indonesian compass. And the difficulty with a small wooden Indonesian boat is that they don't show up on radar until you're very close. And radar then, I mean, this was the radar I was trained on. No computer-based signal processing. This was raw radar. Not all that much advanced from sort of World War II. And you had to look at it carefully and patiently and endure an awful amount of sea clutter and try and find your target in the midst of it. Of course, the charts were poor, and as I keep making the point, the sea lanes themselves are heavily trafficked by the international merchant ships. No GPS, of course, so your navigation is visual. You either look for lighthouses or you look at the coastline with radar or you peer through the night at what land features you can see. And speaking of someone who got lost near the Lombok Strait, I'm sympathetic to the dilemmas of visual navigation in these islands. Now, Higgledon, this photo is quite good in that it shows two twin Vickers 303 caliber machine guns in the bow, two more under the wing of the bridge, where the sailor is, and there are two more obviously on the starboard side. I believe this is the Bren gun. Now, the ship is equipped with a 40mm Beaufort, but obviously if you've got a little Indonesian boat alongside, the Beaufort isn't much help. They had two 20mm Oerlikons after the funnel, but they also had sailors stationed down aft with Bren guns. So there were at least two Bren guns. And this one was manned, if not directly by the commanding officer, but by somebody from the bridge team, and that became the target indication gun. Tracer bullets in the magazine, and at night you opened up with the Bren, and the other gunners saw what direction it was going in and shot at the target based on where the Bren gun was firing. So it sounds a little bit like a Hollywood Western, but it was, and it worked. So the specialist minesweeper support ship was Mull of Kintyre. I think she was Canadian, built a wartime freighter, taken over. And you can see three of the Conn-class sweepers alongside. And this was obviously a special occasion. So some senior officer coming to inspect them. But these are two of the Ham-class minesweepers alongside. So they were smaller than the Ton class, and obviously patrolling closer in shallower waters. And this is a glimpse of the rivers of Borneo. To get to Kuching, you had to go up the river. There were various deep, fast-flowing rivers, and the soldiers ashore appreciated the occasional visit from the inshore flotilla. But you can imagine also, if you're aboard the minesweeper, being nervous as to who might be hiding in the trees and armed with an AK-47. But this was part of their routine. Now, the north east coast of Borneo is where North Borneo and Indonesian Borneo overlap. And this is the area called Tawau. And it became one of the flashpoints that the Indonesians there, presumably out of a sense of idealism, were very trigger happy. So the habit was that a frigate would be stationed there for obviously its gun support up here. This is just an enlargement because I was trying to get to the particular area. The minesweepers took turns. Now, bearing in mind, pink is the British area. This is a very old map, and the yellow is Indonesia. And you can see the border has been drawn, obviously by some thoughtless colonial mandarin, a nice straight line, irrespective of the geography. So this island had Indonesian marines, artillery, and a couple of light tanks with 76mm guns. And this area had largely Royal Marines, who not only had their machine guns, I think they had some artillery, and they weren't going to take any nonsense from anybody. So the worry was that this was the flashpoint that could create a wider war. And the inshore flotilla, by night, anchored up here, and then by day, came right down to where the borderline was, and right in front of the Indonesian forts to basically say, shoot us if you dare. And that went on and on in the hot tropics. Nothing, you know. That was a demanding commitment with the knowledge that your adrenaline was running all the time because you couldn't take the Indonesian Marines for granted. You probably couldn't take the Royal Marines for granted either. But that was part of a very deliberate patrol and daily deterrence aspect of it, and it was probably one of the more demanding tasks that they had. I should have found a map of the Straits of Malacca and the islands of, around Singapore, because again, it's an area where the Indonesian border is very close to Singapore, very close to the south part of Malaya, today Malaysia, and it was the same issue. The Indonesians didn't want you to cross their border. How trigger happy were they? And how good was your navigation that you could say at a subsequent board of inquiry that we weren't there? So there was a lot going on and a lot of stress for the ship's companies. So this really just serves a little microcosm of at the northeast side of Borneo where the war could have easily turned nasty very quickly. And that was the environment. And I'm sure, Mr. Hayward, you would have, you know, on the ground it was presumably even more so. You probably at least had the ability to shoot and relieve your tensions that way. Now, I don't have any suitable photographs here, sadly, but the in the middle of 1966, politics in Indonesia had realised that confrontation wasn't going anywhere, costing them a lot, losing respect, etc., etc. And I think the generals had a quiet word with Mr. Sukarno, and negotiations were entered into, and by June 1966, the two sides were talking, and the whole confrontation was winding down. And so HMS NZS Higgleton, which was on patrol off Borneo, was told to come on home back to Singapore, and incidentally, get ready for an inspection by Sir Bernard Ferguson, who was our Governor General at the time. He was up there seeing the lads, and so the ship, fresh from Borneo, was going to be inspected by the Governor General. Naturally, the First Lieutenant had everybody at work. Put the guns away, take the ammunition off, and start painting and polishing and make the ship respectable. And with that in mind, they approach Horsburgh Light. Horsburgh Light is a significant landmark just outside of Singapore. And so you feel your home when you sight Horsburgh Light. And it was there they ran across a sampan, or they called it a sampan, a comfort, with three uniformed Indonesian Marines and a boatman. And as we were to later learn, a fair bit of ammunition aboard. So when the sampan refused to stop and tried to play silly buggers going round in circles inside the turning circle of the minesweeper, the captain himself, Peter Wright, got the Bren gun and fired a warning shot, which led an Indonesian Marine to pick up a heavy machine gun, it's described as, so I assume a 50 caliber, half-inch caliber machine gun, and he started shooting up the minesweeper. So by this time, of course, the lads started to bring up the weapons and the ammunition, and there was a flurry going on, and so suddenly all the minesweepers' machine guns, or as many as they had, were firing back, and the next thing was that the fuel tank on the Comfort explodes, two of the Indonesians are dead, and the two wounded are subsequently recovered aboard Higgleton, and sure enough, they've got their Indonesian Marine identity discs and papers on them. So they were positively identified as Indonesian Marines. And the burned-out hulk, they were able to recover. The slightly ironic thing at this stage is that the captain, of course, ordered the radio operator to send an emergency signal about an engaging enemy sampan. Please send medical assistance. And in his haste, the radio operator forgot the word medical. And so the next thing, there's a British frigate steaming towards them at 30 knots, and HMS Eagle, the big carrier, prepares to launch an airstrike. I mean, they were reacting to the signal that they had. So I don't think the airstrike actually took off, but the wounded Marines were handed over to the Brit medics aboard the frigate, and sadly subsequently died themselves. They were badly wounded. But this was the last action. It was a very short notice action, and so for the Royal New Zealand Navy, it's the last occasion that we have had in this case, a Distinguished Service Cross awarded to the CO and to the young gunner who did most of the damage with the machine gun, a DSM. And I think both those awards are now old-fashioned awards. We wouldn't see them in the new New Zealand awards, would we? But this was the sort of final part of the naval action, and a sort of one incident only, in itself not very big, but you can imagine for the 30-odd guys in a wooden minesweeper, the thought of half-inch caliber bullets coming through your ship, that got the adrenaline running. It was a serious encounter. And so the conclusion of the whole thing. So 62 to 66, 4 years in confrontation specifically, a state of continually being at armed readiness with a real enemy. And so the naval forces created an iron ring that reduced the amount of infiltration significantly and helped deter the Indonesians. The power of the main fleet ensured that the conventional Indonesian naval forces didn't get too aggressive, They did do things like, you know, try and block the Lombok and Sunda Straits, but they didn't try and invade Malaysian waters. Throughout this, the merchant ship traffic was uninterrupted. The naval forces, of course, still contributed to the CETO and to the UN command in Korea. Those commitments, the commitment of the UN command in Korea still exists today, by the way. We have a ship up there at the moment. And the other point I'd like to make in a fleet that was British, Australian, New Zealand, with the Malaysians and Singaporeans being trained to be part of it, it just underlines the commonality of the training doctrines, the tactical doctrines, the fact that a navy, like any armed force, shouldn't be sort of isolated on its own. You do have to interact with international partners, and the confrontation period was an example of that working all very smoothly and tremendously. And so it is an important, but as I say, sadly overlooked part of our military and naval heritage. And with that, I'm open to questions. I think they, one of the valuable things they could do was, in fact, offer a offer a bath to the guys ashore in Borneo. I think that was frequently done. But yes, they did understand when the soldiers came aboard, they were in pretty bad state, in terms of their personal hygiene. Just the hard realities of being in the Borneo jungles. I mean, Borneo, it was probably described to you. It's steep country. Mount Kinabalu is like about 10,000 feet or so, but the rest of it is like disappearing into the Tararuas. Would that be a fair idea? Yes. So the troops on the ground, they were not thinking of baths and Old Spice, were they? Yeah. The SAS, I suspect this is sort of some untold stories. Jerry Wright, who is the author of A Kiwi on Our Funnel, which focuses on the two minesweepers, he makes the point that every now and then the commanding officer would get a special signal that he wasn't allowed to share with anybody else, pointing out that there might be some boat traffic in your patrol area. And don't shoot at it, because it's not coming from Indonesia, it's going the other way. So I think there are some untold stories there too. The high command knew they were fighting a serious conflict. The potential for it to blow up was high, but the Indonesian infiltrators had real weapons, real bombs. There was a couple of bombing atrocities in Singapore. This was not child's play. This was serious. So the soldiers ashore, if they could get a shower or a bath aboard a minesweeper, we were usually very grateful.
Dave, have you got any further comment on that?
The rum was good.
Yes, I kept forgetting that with the days of the rum regime. Yes, that would have covered a lot of transactions, wouldn't it? Yes, yeah. It was a joint service theatre. There was a unified commander in charge of the Commonwealth forces in the area, in the far, what the Brits call the Far East. So it was joint warfare in that sense. As I say, a demanding time. I mean, the Brits kept cycling out. All their aircraft carriers cycled through Singapore during confrontation. Now there's a serious commitment in itself, let alone obviously the fuel tankers, the cruisers and destroyers and so on and so forth. So, and I guess what I haven't mentioned is, you know, we provided people to staff both not only the headquarters, but to help train the Malaysians and Singaporeans. You know, there was quite a deep relationship there. So Australia, ourselves, and the Brits, it was multifaceted. I mean, it wasn't just fighting a conflict, it was nation building for Malaysia and Singapore too. So it was a demanding time. And of course, it all then gets overshadowed by Vietnam, which was probably a great textbook example of how not to nation build, but that's not my story. Yeah.
Could you go back to the slide of the guard
ship? The Tawau,
yeah. How did you get in and out of there?
Well, you have to, we're nearly there. Should perhaps the map of Indonesia. You come around the north of Borneo, so you're coming around to the east side. So when the British colonised the area, for whatever reason, North Borneo was a fairly generous chunk. And as I say, the sort of colonial era borders were written by a bureaucrat with a pink chin and a far removed, we'll see. But you'd have to come in and into Kawi Harbour here. And there's an island. This is an island, so there's a strait here that is narrow. They actually did their own surveying. You know, the first minesweeper in made a sketch map, the next one added to it, and they essentially sort of made a chart on the fly, as it were, and would hover in there. Because, of course, they weren't allowed in Indonesian waters. So you would feel pretty constrained and restricted there. Yeah.
Especially with jungle on either side.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And trigger-happy Indonesians. Yes. Close by, yeah. It's you know, we don't have a proper scale on this one, but believe me, it's narrow waters and steep country. Yes.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I haven't dug into that too deeply. As you can probably see, the presentation was starting to grow. That's a good question. I'll have to do my homework on it. It was sufficient that the Royal Marines became the, you know, the British forces on the spot. So they weren't put there lightly. There must have been some conflict as part of that. Yes, it's one of the commando carriers. A helicopter carrier. Yes.
That sounds like Peter's going to give a presentation next year. Yeah. And the other thing too, I mean, we take it for granted, but for any of you that have been in the jungle, you don't scrub up every day. Because if you use soap, you can smell it for miles. I mean, if you wanted the enemy to sniff you out, all you needed to do was to keep nice. I could see Evan smile again. But, smoking, which was a bad end in the jungle, but nevertheless, there were certain disciplines that you had to maintain. Otherwise, you'd be detected quite easily. So a lot of people take it for granted today. So you can imagine, you know, sweat building up over a period of time. Your clothing was absolutely soaking most of the time. It wasn't a picnic, that's for sure. All right. Well, look, thanks very much, Richard. So, without further ado, can we please put our hands together again for Richard? And,